Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Turns 25 years old. That's right, 25 years of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear in the corporate media. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. Nothing is more important to us than telling you the truth. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now and make your $25 contribution in honor of our 25th anniversary and help us stay on air for another 25 years and then another 25 after that. Thank you so much. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. This is Democracy Now!
Trump stormed our house with the mob he incited, and we defended our house. And he violated our Constitution, and we defended the Constitution. And they tried to trash our democracy, and we revived it, and we protected it.
Democratic lawmakers have announced plans to set up a 9/11 commission-style panel to investigate the deadly insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. We'll speak with Nation journalist Eli Mistal about why he wants to see Donald Trump in jail. And then we'll talk to Ecuadorian presidential candidate Andrés Arauz, a protege of former President Rafael Correa. Arauz won the first round of the election after vowing to fight austerity, poverty, and the pandemic.
There is no doubt. We are in first place. We have received an overwhelming vote from different parts of our country. As I said earlier, it is a victory representative of the entire national territory.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has authorized a 9/11-style commission to further investigate the January 6th insurrection, as well as the actions that led up to it. This comes as calls are growing for the criminal prosecution of former President Donald Trump as one of the last paths left to hold him accountable after Saturday's vote in the Senate fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to find him guilty. Seven Republicans voted with Democrats to convict, among them North Carolina Senator Richard Burr. On Monday, North Carolina's Republican Party formally censured Burr over his vote, joining similar votes against Senators Bill Cassidy of Louisiana and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Republican officials in Maine and Utah are also considering censure votes against Susan Collins and Mitt Romney over their votes to convict Trump. After headlines, we'll have the latest on the fight to hold Trump accountable for the insurrection and the fight within the Republican Party over Trump's legacy. A massive Arctic air mass settled over the central United States Monday, spawning deadly accidents, leaving millions without power, breaking records for snowfall and low temperatures from Nebraska to Oklahoma to Texas. In Houston, 1.4 million people remained without electricity for a second straight day after Houston recorded an all-time record low of just 17 degrees. This is Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner.
It is a system-wide failure across the state. These are not rolling blackouts. These are power outages at a huge, unprecedented scale.
Climate scientists say severe winter weather has become much more frequent as the Arctic warms rapidly due to human activity. The United States recorded 989 deaths from COVID-19 Monday as the daily death toll fell below 1,000 for the first time since November. The seven-day average of new cases has dropped from January's high to less than 100,000 per day, but remains higher than a second surge of U.S. infections seen last summer. In Louisiana, officials have canceled Mardi Gras events, including today's Fat Tuesday celebration, 1 year after Mardi Gras became an early super spreader event. here in New York. Governor Andrew Cuomo is facing an investigation for not initially reporting close to half the 15,000 coronavirus deaths at nursing homes and other long-term care facilities during the pandemic. On Monday, Cuomo acknowledged his role but stopped short of an apology.
We should have provided more information faster. We were too focused on doing the job and addressing the crisis of the moment, and we did not do a good enough job in providing information. I take total responsibility for that.
Republican state senators are calling for Governor Cuomo's impeachment. They're also demanding a special session to strip Cuomo of his emergency powers, a call that at least 14 Democratic state senators have joined. Democrat Jessica Ramos tweeted, quote, "People died and Cuomo lied. Then he had the gall to write a book," she said. It's a reference to Cuomo's bestseller, American Crisis, Leadership Lessons from the COVID-19 Pandemic, which does not include information on how many New York nursing home residents died of coronavirus. The World Health Organization has granted emergency use authorization to the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine. It's just the second vaccine after Pfizer's to be approved for the WHO's COVAX initiative aimed at bringing vaccines to lower-income countries across the world. On Monday, the new head of the World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, warned against vaccine nationalism, saying attempts by wealthier nations to hoard vaccines would backfire.
The pandemic is a problem of the global commons. So taking care of your population and being nationalistic with respect to vaccines won't work this time.
The new head of the WTO is Nigeria's former finance minister and managing director of the World Bank. On Monday, she became the first woman and the first African appointed to lead the World Trade Organization. In northern Iraq, a civilian contractor was killed. 9 people were injured Monday in a rocket attack on a U.S. military base in the city of Erbil, the capital of Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish region in the north. A little-known Shia organization calling itself Guardians of Blood claimed responsibility, promising it would carry out more attacks targeting the U.S. occupation. The New York Times reports Taliban fighters have surrounded major population centers across Afghanistan as the Biden administration weighs whether to honor an agreement with the Taliban to withdraw the remaining 2,500 U.S. troops by May 1st. On Monday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the U.S.-led military alliance is not ready to withdraw from Afghanistan.
While no ally wants to stay in Afghanistan longer than necessary, we will not leave before the time is right.
Earlier this month, a congressionally appointed panel known as the Afghanistan Study Group recommended the Biden administration should renege on its agreement to withdraw from Afghanistan by May. The U.S. is removing Yemen's Houthi rebels from the government's list of foreign terrorist organizations, reversing a last-minute move by the Trump administration, which Yemenis and international aid groups warned would only worsen the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. This comes as the U.N. warns hundreds of thousands of children in Yemen could die this year from severe acute malnutrition unless they receive urgent care. The World Food Program cut food rations to millions last year due to a lack of funds. This is Abdul Malik al-Wahedi, the head of a Sana Hospital malnutrition ward.
There are several reasons for the increase in malnutrition. For example, the withdrawal of aid organizations, the rise in price of oil, organizations that no longer provide medication, basic nutrition needs, food aid, especially in conflict zones.
In the Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara, renowned Sahrawi activist Sultana Khaya was brutally assaulted last weekend by Moroccan agents in her home in the city of Boujdour, where she and her entire family have been held under house arrest since last November 19th, days after the renewal of armed conflict in the territory. On February 13th, Sultana was waving a large flag from a rooftop when the police commissioner of Boujdour hurled a rock and struck her in the head. Videos and photographs of the assault and of Khaya's head injuries went viral. The next day, dozens of Sahrawi women approached the family home in solidarity, but were beaten away by police. As Sultana protested her house arrest, the same police officer struck her in the back of her neck with a nightstick, and she again passed out. Chaya's family is worried about her injuries, but say Morocco-run hospitals are not safe places for Sahrawi activists, and police have not allowed the family to summon a doctor to the house. In 2016, Democracy Now! Interviewed Sultana Chaya for our documentary 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. You can watch the film at democracynow.org. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 60 people were killed and hundreds more remain missing after an overloaded ferry boat capsized in the Congo River. Officials say the modified whaling vessel had about 700 passengers on board and that so far only 300 survivors have been found. Palestinian authorities say Israel's halted the shipment of 2,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the Gaza Strip, where they were due to be administered to frontline medical workers. The besieged territory is home to more than 2 million people, but has yet to receive any vaccine. This comes as Israeli health officials reported a nearly 95% drop in symptomatic coronavirus infections among 600,000 Israelis who received Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, and 30% of Israeli citizens have received at least one vaccine dose, the highest rate of any major nation. But that figure excludes Palestinians in the occupied territories who remain largely unvaccinated. Back in the United States, a federal appeals court has thrown out an Arkansas state law prohibiting government contractors from participating in boycotts of Israel, ruling it violates their First Amendment rights. In a statement celebrating the ruling, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, known as CARE, said, quote, just as African Americans had the constitutional right to participate in the Montgomery bus boycott, and just as anti-apartheid activists had the constitutional right to boycott South Africa's government, every American has the constitutional right to boycott the Israeli government over its human rights abuses of Palestinians, CARE wrote. A warning to our audience, the next stories contain disturbing images and descriptions of violence. In Missouri, the city of St. Louis is paying a $5 million settlement to a black police officer who was assaulted by white officers in 2017 while working undercover at an anti-police brutality protest. Luther Hall was reportedly thrown to the ground, kicked and beaten with a baton, leaving him severely injured. In a lawsuit filed in 2019, Hall says the white officers then tried to cover up the assault. At least 4 officers involved in the attack were federally indicted in 2018. In California, an investigation is underway after a Los Angeles police officer reported fellow officers made and circulated a Valentine's Day meme with an image of George Floyd and the words, "You take my breath away." L.A. County District Attorney George Gascon wrote on Twitter, quote, celebrating the murder of a black man at the hands of police demonstrates a profound absence of humanity, unquote. Last summer, massive racial justice protests erupted across the country and the world in response to the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. A viral video shows white police officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes while Floyd repeatedly gasped for air and said, "I can't breathe." In New Jersey, advocates are demanding the firing of 2 Paterson police officers involved in the beating of a Muslim Arab American teen this past December. Osama Al-Saidi, who was 19 at the time of the assault, posted the video on social media. The video shows officers Kevin Patino and Marcos Martinez apprehending Al-Saidi while he's walking. One of the officers is seen repeatedly punching Al-Saidi, who is then tackled to the ground, where the officers continue to beat him. Al-Saidi was reportedly later diagnosed with a concussion and head trauma. The Council on American-Islamic Relations said in a statement, quote, to see such a reprehensible attack happen at the hands of those who supposedly serve and protect Paterson residents is more than disheartening. It's revolting and deserving of immediate punishment, Kerr said. The New Jersey Attorney General's Office has launched an investigation. And in Guatemala, dozens of girls and women led a bike caravan in Guatemala City Saturday, protesting skyrocketing violence against women, children and youth in the country. The protesters rode their bikes to the Constitutional Plaza, lining up in front of the presidential palace, where they were met with police. Chants of "We just want to play in peace" echoed through the crowd of young girls.
No more missing girls. We demand justice.
Protests erupted following the recent killing of 8-year-old Sharon Figueroa. Her body was found last week in a northern region of Guatemala after she went missing for 2 days. In 2020 alone, nearly 500 femicides were reported in Guatemala, and at least 60 children were killed. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. When we come back, Democratic lawmakers are setting up a 9/11 commission-style panel to investigate the deadly insurrection at the Capitol on January 6. We'll speak with the Nation magazine journalist Eli Mistal about why he wants to see Donald Trump in jail. Spoken by the legendary drummer Milford Graves, who died last week at the age of 79. Graves was a musician, a professor, a medical researcher, an acupuncturist, herbalist, and martial artist. He spent years studying human heart vibrations to better understand music's healing potential. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has authorized a 9/11-style commission to further investigate the deadly January 6th insurrection, as well as the actions that led up to it. This comes as calls are growing for the criminal prosecution of former President Donald Trump as one of the last paths left to hold him accountable for the attack after Saturday's vote in the Senate fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to find him guilty. 7 Republicans voted with Democrats to convict. Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell was not among them. But during his speech Saturday, McConnell intimated Trump could still be held criminally responsible in a court of law.
Put another way, in the language of today, President Trump is still liable for everything he did while he was in office as an ordinary citizen, unless the statute of limitations is run, still liable for everything he did while he's in office. Didn't get away with anything yet. Yet.
For more, we're joined by Eli Mistal, the nation's justice correspondent, author of the magazine's monthly column, Objection. His recent column is headlined, "Republicans Won't Convict Trump Because They Won't Convict Themselves." Eli, in lead up to this, you wrote another column headlined, "I Don't Just Want Trump Impeached, I Want Him Jailed." And you argued, quote, Trump should be charged with incitement of criminal acts at the very least. Trump is not a defeated politician. He's a criminal on the loose. He must be treated as such. Can you take that further?
Yeah, so I think that the House impeachment managers actually laid out a very good criminal case against Donald Trump. Now, criminal indictment was not the standard that they had to meet for impeachment. They just did that for funsies. The Senate could have convicted without finding criminal liability, but Jamie Raskin and the rest of the managers actually did lay out to me a fairly compelling case for criminal liability based on not just his speech on January 6th, which was incendiary, but his actions leading up to January 6th and how that can potentially be enough to indict him for criminal incitement. It's a tough case. I'm not going to lie. Like it is difficult to it should be difficult to indict and convict anybody for incitement based on just words. That is a fundamental part of the First Amendment's protection of free speech. But telling people, let's go storm the Capitol, for instance, is not protected speech. And what Trump did is much closer to unprotected speech than it is to protected speech. So I think there's a case for indictment. I think we should at least try. Republicans have failed this country so completely that now it's up to law enforcement as the only place that can try.
So speaking of law enforcement, the D.C. Attorney General and U.S. Attorney there are possibly weighing incitement of violence criminal charges against Trump. Can you explain what that would look like?
Yeah, so I want to roll back for a second, right? Because the D.C. Attorney General, they still haven't arrested all of the people who stormed the Capitol, right? So I kind of almost want them to slow down, right? They've only arrested about 200 of the 800 people that stormed the Capitol. Every person who set foot in that building is a criminal. Every single person who set foot in that building, at the very least, committed federal criminal trespass. And the current law enforcement hasn't gotten around to finding and indicting all of those people. So they got a lot of work to do beyond President Trump, beyond former President Trump. However, once they do the bare minimum, which is finding and charging all 800 people who stormed the Capitol, then they can get around to Trump, who, yeah, again, the standard that they talked about at the impeachment trial is actually the right standard for a criminal case. It's called the Brandenburg test. It's how we determine whether or not speech is protected or unprotected. And Trump likely failed all three elements of the Brandenburg test. What he said was likely to cause violence, was likely to be interpreted by the crowd as a call to violence. It was likely to incite imminent lawless action. I mean, literally, he was telling them to march down the street that day, and in fact did cause imminent lawless action. One thing that I like people to remember when thinking about this as a criminal case, what did he expect them to do at the Capitol? If you think about like a free speech rally or, you know, a protest rally, there was nothing organized at the Capitol. There was no slate of speakers at the Capitol. When he tells them to march down to the Capitol to cheer on their Republican colleagues, there was no way for those people to get. That was a closed session of Congress, right? So when he tells people to march to the Capitol, where there's no event planned, where there's no permit gotten, to go see a closed section session of Congress, the only thing they could do to carry out his wishes was to illegally trespass into the building and do what they did. So that's going to be, I think, that is a key element for people to remember when trying to determine whether or not his speech was protected or should be protected or not.
So can you talk about what Ron Johnson is now saying? The very close Trump ally, a Wisconsin Republican senator, who was mocking any claims that this was an armed insurrection, saying that I mean, you have, of course, the images of gallows that were erected, the zip ties, the hurling of fire extinguisher, using baseball bats to smash windows, throwing flags like spears at police officers and beating them with these flagpoles, the stun baton that's clearly in the waistband of the man who is sitting in Nancy Pelosi's office as they steal things from her office. But there you have Ron Johnson just weeks later saying, armed insurrection? You got to be kidding.
Look, Amy, to be honest, I can't explain what nearly any of these Republican senators say or think. I have never lived one day of my life as much of a coward as Ron Johnson. So I don't know what it's like to be that afraid of the truth that you're willing to lie to people about what they saw with their own eyes. So I can't explain what he's saying. As you pointed out, it was clearly an armed insurrection. The first guy through the window was wearing tactical gear and carrying the Confederate flag. The first guy through the window that he had to break down. This was an armed attempt at a rebellion. There's no denying that. You know, Republicans are invested, and this is why you need. This is why, even though we can talk about, you know, the strategy of impeachment, this is why you needed an impeachment trial to establish the record. This is why Nancy Pelosi has commissioned the investigation into what happened. You need to have a public record of what went on, because Republicans will try to memory hole the entire day. Like, it doesn't work for them to acknowledge that that day existed. So in the Republican mind, we didn't have a leap year. We had a skip year in 2021. We went from January 5th to January 7th without anything in between, according to Republicans. That's how they're going to try to make the rest of the country think. And that's why we need things like a commission, like the trial, to remember what happened.
Very interestingly, you have Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan, like many of the conservatives, saying that cancel culture is the biggest threat facing the United States, while one state party, Republican Party after another, censures those senators who voted to convict Donald Trump.
It's actually a great way to expose the Republican hypocrisy about cancel culture, right? Because there is nothing more canceling than censuring people for what they voted on or what they said, when their job is to vote and say things, right? There is no lower form of canceling than what Republicans themselves do. And it's just another way to understand that Republicans are inveterate hypocrites that do not argue in good faith ever. So, yeah, it's what the Republicans are doing is pathetic, frankly. And I do give almost grudgingly, but I do give credit to the Republican senators and the Republican congresspeople, the few, the proud, who are saying enough of this, and at least here at the end. I mean, it's late in the game. It's late in the game to join the side of truth and decency. But I do give, you know, the Bill Cassidys and the Mitt Romneys of the world and the Richard Burrs of the world, I guess, credit for, you know, at the very end, at least, like, doing the right thing.
Well, let's go to South Carolina Senator, the Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, speaking on Fox News Sunday, where he falsely claimed there were grounds to impeach Vice President Kamala Harris, that she would be next.
I condemn what happened on January the 6th, but the process they used to impeach this president was an affront to rule of law. He's the first president to ever be impeached without a lawyer, without a witness, without ability to confront those against him. And the trial record was a complete joke, hearsay upon hearsay. And we've opened Pandora's box to future presidents. And if you use this model, I don't know how Kamala Harris doesn't get impeached if the Republicans take over the House, because she actually bailed out rioters, and one of the rioters went back to the streets and broke somebody's head open. So we've opened Pandora's box here, and I'm sad for the country.
Senator Graham seemed to suggest Vice President Harris could be punished for expressing support for a bail fund for Black Lives Matter protesters in Minnesota last summer, who were protesting the police killing of George Floyd. Ellie Mistel.
It's interesting, right? It's interesting that he went straight for Harris, isn't it? I mean, I wonder why she went for the person who's vice president as opposed to the person who's president now. Oh, yeah, she's a black woman. The racism of that man is so on display every day. And I get that he's from South Carolina, so people are just like, well, I guess it's South Carolina. But it's not okay. These people are so openly and bitterly racist. It's bothersome. However, the other, there is funny here, right? And that is that Lindsey Graham wants to impeach a black woman for a legal act, which is bail. Like, bail is legal. Like, whatever you think about why she bailed, and again, why they think that this was a bad thing is drenched and inseparable from their racism. But whether or not you think bail is legal, is the reasons for bailing somebody out are good or bad, paying somebody's bail is clearly legal. That's why we have it. We have literally entire organizations called bail bondsmen whose their whole job, their whole business model is to pay people's bail. So the thought of impeaching her for a legal act is just, but there's a political reality here too, right? And something that I think Democrats are too easy to forget. Of course, if the Republicans take back control of the House, they will impeach people. Of course they will. They would have impeached Hillary Clinton if she had won the presidency for stuff that she did as Secretary of State. They would have impeached her for Benghazi, which killed fewer Americans than the riots on January 6th, just FYI. They would have impeached her for Benghazi. If they didn't impeach her for Benghazi, they would have impeached her three other times for things I don't even know happened yet, right? The Republicans have no shame. The Republicans have no fealty to the rule of law. All the Republicans know is power, and they use that power completely whenever they have the chance. So make no mistake, if the Republicans ever control the House again, they will impeach whoever happens to be Democratic president if there is still a Democrat in office when they control the House. That will just happen.
So we interviewed Ralph Nader on Friday, strong proponent of having witnesses. You, too, feel that the Democrats failed in that way, that having witnesses come forward could have made the difference.
Well, see, OK, that's the slight difference, right? I don't think that having witnesses would have made a difference in the outcome of a trial, because, again, Republicans are racist to the core. They are hypocritical to the core. They're intellectually dishonest to the core. Nothing was going to change the Republican mind. Witnesses, 10 witnesses, I think Jamie Raskin said, you could have called 100 witnesses. They would have done the same thing. Jamie Raskin was absolutely right about that. You cannot change a Republican mind. The difference is that I don't live my life based on what the Republicans think or don't think, right? If I only did what Republicans allowed me to do, instead of having a law degree, I'd be shining shoes at Grand Central. Okay, so like, I don't live in the paper bag that is what will Lindsey Graham do next, because I don't care about that. What I care about is the American people. And I do think that bringing witnesses, bringing live testimony to bear would have highlighted even more, for even more Americans, the level of danger this country was placed in and exactly who placed them in it. So, yeah, there's some procedural issues. Oh, well, Kevin McCarthy, he would have made you go for a subpoena. Fine. Don't call Kevin McCarthy then. Put the cops on the stand. I want to hear Eugene Goodman. They gave him a medal. I want to hear his testimony of what he saw that day, what they called him that day, what happened to him that day. Put him on the stand. Put one of these staffers that had to spend 2 hours hiding under a desk. Put one of them on the stand. Do everything you can. And I've said this before, the point of this impeachment trial was not to convince Republicans. Republicans are unconvincible. The point was to expose Republicans for the dirt that they do. And witnesses would have done a better job doing that.
I mean, it did change some Republicans. The Louisiana Senator Cassidy, the North Carolina Senator Burr.
Okay. I think the actions changed their minds. I don't think that the impeachment trial, like, I don't think that if Jamie Raskin was great, Stacey Plaskett was great, the impeachment managers were great. If they were average, I don't think that would have made a difference. Like, I don't think it was the strength of their legal arguments that made Richard Burr what happened is that Donald Trump sent a mob to kill congressmen to their workplace, and a couple of Republican senators were like, that's not okay. That's not okay.
So let's talk about some of the information that's come to the surface about the insurrection participants. The New York Times reporting at least six people who were part of the mob that entered the Capitol, worked as security for Trump ally Roger Stone, were linked to the far-right Oath Keepers. HuffPost reporting at least 57 state and local Republican officials were at the Capitol insurrection. Almost all have faced calls to resign. Two have stepped down, I believe, at this point, both arrested for taking part in the riot. In one case, a Florida County Commissioner Joe Mullins sponsored buses to transport people to D.C. in the lead up to the January 6th. He said on a local radio program, maybe there are some liberals that'd like to see their heads cut off. But let's talk about, for example, the Oath Keepers and the actual number of law enforcement people like Caldwell, who have had top security clearance, who worked for the federal government. In the end, they had to put National Guardsmen through the test and remove something like 12 of them that they might have allegiances to the white supremacists who were rioting.
I mean, black people have been saying this for a while, right? White supremacy and law enforcement are kind of the same thing. They work for the same people. They are the same people in many cases. And it's not all of them, but enough of them to make a difference. You know, I always like to say the phrase is not one bad apple means that we should just ignore it and people should not care if that bad apple kills them. That's not the phrase. The phrase is one bad apple spoils the bunch. And law enforcement in this country is spoiled by white supremacy. There are white supremacist terrorists in every police organization in this country. And until we weed them out, we cannot have justice in law enforcement. Until we weed them out, not until we look over them, not until we flood them with, we'll add some 10 more cops and 9 of them will be good. That's not how you have to weed out the bad apples before they kill people. And that's what the insurrection, the riot on January 6th just exposed just how intertwined some in law enforcement are with very openly white supremacist and violent organizations. That's not an accident. That's a thing. That's a feature of our law enforcement system. And it's led to the death and brutality of black people and brown people. And we tell people this and we complain about this, you know, like what's going to happen now, right? People, we'll prosecute some of them, right? We'll prosecute. We won't, for reasons passing understanding, we won't prosecute all. They'll come up with some excuse to not prosecute all of them. We'll prosecute some of them. And then the kinds of screening and whatever that went into the National Guard to make sure that none of the actual defenders of the inauguration were part of these white supremacist groups. Are you going to keep doing that in the National Guard? Are we going to port that to local law enforcement? Is NYPD going to strain everybody through a white supremacy screener to make sure that none of them are members of Oath Keepers or Proud Boys or are on Facebook sharing memes from the Oath Keepers? Are we going to do that or not? And the answer most often in this country is that white people will not do that, will not take it through, will not think it through, will not do what is necessary to protect us from them.
Ellie Mistel, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Nation's justice correspondent, author of the magazine's monthly column, Objection. His recent column headlined, Republicans won't convict Trump because they won't convict themselves. Next up, we speak with the Ecuadorian presidential candidate, Andrés Arauz, a protege of former President Rafael Correa. Arauz won the first round of the election after vowing to fight austerity, poverty, and the pandemic. Stay with us.
Bye.
by the late Celia Cruz and the Dominican salsa musician Johnny Pacheco, who died yesterday at the age of 85. He founded the Latin music label Fania Records, credited for bringing salsa to a worldwide audience. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ecuador is preparing to hold a partial recount of its February 7th presidential election. The left-wing economist Andres Arauz placed first, securing nearly 33% of the vote, a third of the vote, but fell short of the 40% needed to avoid a runoff. Arauz has pledged to end austerity measures imposed by Ecuador's right-wing president, Lenin Moreno, who did not seek re-election. It remains unclear who Arauz will face in a runoff election on April 11th. Guillermo Lasso is currently in second place with 19.74% of the vote. Lasso is a right-wing banker running for president for the third time. An indigenous candidate, Yaku Perez, who ran partly on an anti-extraction platform, has 19.38% of the vote. The frontrunner, Andres Arauz, has been described as a protege of former Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa, who led the country from 2007 to 2017 and has been credited with lifting over a million Ecuadorians out of poverty. Arauz served in Correa's administration as director of Ecuador's central bank and later as minister of knowledge and human talent. He just turned 36 years old, would be Ecuador's youngest president if elected. Correa considered running for vice president under him on a ticket. But Correa was prevented from doing so because he faces an 8-year jail sentence on alleged corruption violations imposed by the Moreno government. Correa is now living in exile in Belgium. The election comes as Ecuador is facing an economic and public health crisis. At least 15,000 people have died in Ecuador from COVID-19, the actual number of deaths believed to be far higher. Ecuador recorded an excess toll of 40,000 deaths last year. Millions of Ecuadorians have fallen into poverty over the past year. We're joined now by the Ecuadorian presidential candidate, Andres Arauz, who's on a short visit to the United States. He is joining us from New York City. We welcome you to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Amy. It's good to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation, and I'm glad to be sharing here with the Ecuadorian community in New York and also with possible investors and the financial community here in New York City.
Because the Ecuadorian community here in New York can vote, is that right?
Yes, Ecuadorians can vote abroad, and they can also elect representatives to our national parliament. That was one of the innovations of the 2008 Constitution, among many others, such as including rights for nature and the concept of buen vivir, or good living.
So talk about the problems Ecuador faces, why you ran, what it means to be, as you call yourself, a heterodox economist. You're the presidential front runner. We'll talk about who you might face in the runoff. But the dramatic crises that Ecuador is facing right now, from the economy to the pandemic.
Well, we're facing a double crisis right now. Basically, one of the pandemic where the government was absolutely negligent regarding its management. We have the highest death toll after Peru in the world. This is a very serious case. Our numbers do not match. The Ecuadorian efforts at fighting the pandemic have been null. There have only been around 4,000 vaccines that have been delivered for a population of 17 million plus. And basically, the public health system has been under the strain of austerity. There have been over 6,000 public servants in the health system that have been fired during the pandemic because of stringent austerity policies that have had a huge impact on the Ecuador's population, increasing poverty and inequality. So we have to face these two crises simultaneously, and we're proposing an aggressive investment plan, including emergency aid similar to the paychecks that have been delivered here in the U.S., to the most vulnerable in the Ecuadorian population. But also we intend to have an aggressive program to have the vaccine available for most of Ecuador's population as a public service in the short term. This is very important for us to overcome these two crises in the very short term, because we're now facing what we call a lack of trust within Ecuadorian society. And we need to fix that as soon as possible. Otherwise, this might become even a humanitarian crisis.
You have been described as Correa's pick to be the next president of Ecuador. Can you explain what you agree with Correa in his decade presidency? You served, of course, in his administration. What you agree with and what you disagree with?
Well, we have had huge advances in terms of investment in infrastructure, higher quality education, a public health system that has been crucial to fight the pandemic. We created rebuilt over 52 hospitals around the country. If those hadn't been available, the death toll would have been even higher. So I think most of the Ecuadorian population agrees that the investment in the social sector, in infrastructure, in the productive sector of the economy was very important to promote Ecuador's development and to get closer to our paradigm of buen vivir, of good living. However, there are many issues where we differ. For example, Rafael Correa was much more active in terms of establishing differences with the political opponents, with confrontation with the media, for example. We think that freedom of expression is a human right. And as a human right, there are human rights legislations that should be enough to cover, for example, issues with the media and freedom of expression. Also, I think now we need a renewal in our politics. We're trying to promote a new generation of politicians and new and fresher ideas that have to do with creativity, innovation, the role of the digital economy, where we think we have huge opportunities for the Ecuadorian population once we go through these parallel crises that have been hitting our economy and our population very hard.
How do you plan on renegotiating the debt? You have said that you would cancel the IMF debt. Massive protests took place last year against the Moreno government for their austerity measures.
Yes, we had an uprising in October 2019 after the government of Moreno basically, on one stroke, increased over 200% the price of gasoline and diesel. That was a huge hit to the Ecuadorian people. So the people came out to the streets. And now there was huge repression, over 1,200 people that were jailed, many people that were killed, around a dozen or so. And this is not justifiable by any means in our country. We are against the austerity policies that were pursued by the government of Lenin Moreno. We want to implement a heterodox economic policy that will increase public investment, that will increase social protection for the population, and that will in itself create economic recovery in the short and the medium term. So this is what we're proposing, and including an emergency package for a million vulnerable families in the Ecuadorian population. Also, incredibly, the pandemic has created a new problem, which is lack of internet access for about half of Ecuador's student population that hasn't been able to continue their studies because of lack of internet. So we also need an emergency internet program, which implies large infrastructure investment to cover the entire Ecuadorian territory with quality internet for Ecuadorians, especially for youngsters.
So one of your opponents, the indigenous environmentalist Yaku Perez, ran on a platform calling for an end to mining and other extractive industries in Ecuador. He was arrested fighting mining projects during the Correa administration in which you served. He was jailed under his administration. The world is facing a climate catastrophe. Do you support these calls to end mining? And also, how would you improve relations with Ecuador's indigenous communities that were strained under President Correa?
Well, I think Yaku Perez's arrest at the time was a mistake. I think that made him famous. But on the other hand, I think it was a bit too much in terms of the policies that were pursued at that moment. I also think that the anti-extractivism agenda has to be perhaps a bit more sophisticated, a bit more detailed, because there are many issues that have to be covered, including, for example, industrialization of the mines, the development of the communities that are in the surrounding areas. We cannot have a neocolonial extractivist agenda, but we can perhaps pursue a development-oriented mining and oil and agricultural agenda that takes into account the needs of the local communities and makes them the main stakeholders in these projects. They have to be linked with an entire educational and technological agenda so that the knowledge and the technology associated with those projects can remain in the country and especially in those communities. Now, I think we have a huge opportunity in Ecuador to propose unity of the progressive sector, the indigenous sector, and the social democracy sector, which, if you take into account in Ecuador in the last election, is above two-thirds of the votes and also two-thirds of the parliamentary representation. So we have a large opportunity to unite the progressive forces of Ecuador and to propose an agenda that furthers the agenda proposed in the Constitution of Ecuador of 2008, which includes what we call a plurinational and intercultural state with the indigenous movement.
So I want to ask you about this runoff and whether you're concerned about it. On Monday, the Organization of American States expressed, quote, concern about Ecuador's election. How concerned are you that the OAS, that the United States, could attempt to overturn this first election?
Well, we're worried in the sense that there has not been a decision, a formal decision on who the two final parties to the runoff are. We know that we're going to be there, but by delaying the decision, there might be an attempt to delay the second round as well and even extend Lenín Moreno's period at the government. That would be unacceptable for the Ecuadorian population. Everybody wants Moreno out. He has been totally negligent with the management of our country, with the administration. So we're worried about that. We're also worried that the possible recount may create incidents that would imply destruction of electoral material. And that's not something that we want. We want a recount that is based on the Constitution, on the law. And if the recount does occur, we need to be present as well. It cannot only be just a discussion between the second and third places. We also need to be there to safeguard that our votes are being monitored, that they are being taken care of.
So let me ask you about Yaku Pérez's position on other countries in Latin America. He is running as an eco-socialist, but also has a long record of publicly criticizing many of Latin America's former progressive leaders, including Brazil's Dilma Rousseff, also Fernandez de Kirchner of Argentina. In 2016, he tweeted, "Corruption ended the governments of Dilma and Cristina. Now all that's missing is for Rafael Correa and Maduro to fall. It's just a matter of time." Yaku Pérez later supported the coup in Bolivia. He talked about Evo Morales as a little dictator. Can you talk about your positions on all of this?
Right. First, I have to clarify that he's not running on an eco-socialist platform. He's basically running on an anti-progressive platform himself, even though the indigenous movement is much more diverse, much more heterogeneous. And the indigenous movement largely also supports our candidacy. We have very good relations with the indigenous movement in Ecuador, and several of our candidates are also from the indigenous movement, including former president of the CONAIE, Ricardo Cuango. So I think the situation is a bit more sophisticated than that, and a bit more nuanced. And we are trying to build consensus and agreements around that area. Right now is not a moment to strengthen the differences, but rather to strengthen the similarities, the points in common that we have with the indigenous movement and with an agenda that has to comply with the Ecuadorian constitution, which is a constitution that recognizes the need for a plurinational state, which means that there has to be degrees of autonomy for the indigenous peoples, that has to include a relationship where the indigenous languages have to be present in the educational system, and many other issues such as those. So we're looking forward to finding huge agreements for our country, for the benefit of the Ecuadorian population. And this is precisely the moment where we have to focus on that.
So what is your position on Venezuela and President Maduro? You have the new Biden administration that talks about a presidency of Juan Guaido. Your thoughts on this? Where do you stand when it comes to Maduro and the Biden administration's position on Venezuela?
I stand with what basically the rest of the world has been saying, that we have to recognize the self-determination of the peoples of Venezuela. The EU has recently changed its position. I'm referring to the European Union. And most of Latin America has a clear agenda to keep peace in the region, right? So we think we need to talk about peace, democracy, development as the key issues in Latin America. We do not want foreign interference in our region. We do not want war in our region. We need peace, and that should be the main, setting stone, the main platform for the conversation about Venezuela or any other country in the region. Now, we believe in regional integration. We believe in the unity of the Latin American peoples, where we have so much in common. And, you know, when you see a powerful bloc such as the European Union, which are so diverse in terms of languages, the economic sectors, the cultures, and in Latin America, very similar agenda, very similar culture, very similar languages. And however, it's taken us so long for full regional integration. So that's where we're going to go forward with that. And we hope the Biden administration will be will stay away from trying to create division within the region. And on the other hand, we'll try to create those spaces for regional integration in the region as well.
Do you believe the OAS can be a fair arbiter, a fair observer of the elections?
I think the OAS has basically two big spaces within itself. First, you have the political realm with Secretary Almagro, which has been a total anti-leftist with a clear anti-left agenda, anti-progressive agenda. He has been very vocal about that, and there is nothing there to hide. But on the other hand, the OAS does have technical teams that have professional credentials in terms of election monitoring. And we hope that in this case, the election observers that come from the technical realm are the ones who will prevail in terms of the process.
What has to happen when it comes to the pandemic? Do you have access to vaccines in Ecuador? Talk about the devastation of COVID-19.
Well, first, we need to come out with the truth. You know, the government has not recognized the total number of deaths that occurred during the pandemic in 2020. Right now, we're seeing a surge in the number of cases. The hospitals are already full again. Ecuador is one of the countries with the lowest standard in terms of testing for the population. We need to have more testing and more aggressive testing throughout the country. We also need, of course, biosafety and biosecurity measures for the population that has not been occurring so far. And, of course, the vaccine. It so happens that the current president and the Minister of Health got a vaccine before the rest of the population and, of course, before our public servants at the health system that are on the front line of the battle against COVID. So this is absolutely grave. It's very serious. There has been an uproar in the Ecuadorian population due to these practices by the Ecuadorian government, and we need to get the vaccine. We have talked with the Argentine president, Fernandez, who will guarantee that a large amount of vaccines, over 4.4 million doses from Argentina that are being produced there, will arrive to Ecuador in our new government. I hope the Ecuadorian government of Lenin Moreno does something about it soon enough, sooner than later. But if he doesn't do anything about it, we will be acting very quickly, very swiftly, starting our government on May 24th.
And very quickly, we're coming up the two-year anniversary of the Moreno government revoking the political asylum for Julian Assange, who was in the embassy for years in Britain. Now the Biden administration says they will continue to pursue his extradition. Your thoughts thoughts on the significance of what Julian Assange represented?
Look, when the asylum was revoked, there were many human rights and civil rights that were violated, including overturning Assange's citizenship as an Ecuadorian citizen. That is something that we will look into and then see how, if that situation changes, how we may act upon that internationally. However, I think Assange's human rights have to be respected. And now with the first decision in the UK courts, it is something to really think about what is happening to a human being such as him. I think we've seen...
We have 5 seconds.
We've seen from President Obama a different perspective on that.
Andres Arauz, we're going to have to leave it there. Well. Ecuadorian presidential candidate, if elected, would become the youngest president of Ecuador. I'm Amy Goodman.